You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, smart, smooth, smoking, smashing, and smoldering smilers. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 17, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your amusing and animated alliteration adorers, admitting assonance abuse. So we have to start off the show, we have a quick correction segment, which we're going to lovingly call...
Actually.
Our last episode, I think we confused assonance with alliteration. Just to clarify everything. So alliteration refers to...
It's at the beginning of words, kind of consecutive words.
Yep. Repetition of consonant sounds at the beginning of consecutive words.
Not necessarily.
It doesn't have to be consonant. It can be vowel as well. Oh, my understanding was it's just repetition of whatever sounds. The sound is at the beginning.
Okay. Yep. So alliteration refers to the repetition of a particular sound in the first syllables of a series of words. Assonance is the repetition of vowel sounds and only vowel sounds to create internal rhyming.
Right,
so it's
right.
Within.
Okay.
An example would be how now brown cow.
Right.
And then there's also consonants. And consonants is the same thing with assonance, but it's with consonants, obviously. Mm. So it's the repetition of the same consonant in short succession. So an example would be all mammals named Sam are clammy. Pitter-patter is both alliteration and consonants because we have the T, P in the beginning for alliteration. So.
Jeez.
Cool. Just, a lot of people wrote in. A lot of word nerds out there.
Yes. We are sorry for being jackassonants.
Sorry.
Jackassonants.
Jackassonants.
We aim to get it right.
Should we introduce ourselves?
Oh, yes. So, of course, I am Karen.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
Yeah.
Hall monitor.
Let's do this. Let's jump into our usual general quiz segment. Pop quiz hotshot. Get your barnyard buzzers ready.
Yes. Grabbed my cock.
Okay.
But what?
Man.
This is a family show.
Starting salty today.
Oh, sassy. Yeah. All right, Blue Wedge, let's go. The Galapagos Islands are part of what country? That was Colin.
I believe it's Ecuador.
Correct. The islands lie about 600 miles west of the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And known for...
Tortoise.
Yeah, tortoises and lizards.
Yeah.
Okay, Pink Wedge, pop culture. On the TV show Arrested Development...
Yes?
What is the name of Michael Bluth's son? That was Dana.
George Michael.
Correct, George Michael. Of course. Played by...
The inestimable Michael Cera. Yeah.
Yes, Michael Cera. And Yellow Wedge... The minimum legal age for what activity was established in July 1984 in most states? Dana.
Is it drinking?
Correct. Huh. Age established was 21, and this was 1984. What was it before?
States had all different drinking ages before.
Right. Oh.
In the 80s, the federal government said that it would start restricting highway funds to states if they didn't make their drinking age 21, on the idea that if a lowered drinking age caused more accidents.
Yeah. Right. Got it.
De facto federal drinking age is 21, but there is no law that says that it has to be 21.
Right.
Okay, let's do Purple Wedge. Who does a Bartolator worship?
Oh.
Chris.
Bart Simpson.
Incorrect. Colin.
I'm assuming it's Bartolator. Would that be William Shakespeare?
Correct.
Oh, yeah. Bartolator.
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 Bart Simpson. Okay, Green Wedge for science. The markings on a tabby cat's head often resemble what letter? What a weird question.
Oh, it's an M.
Is correct. It?
Yeah.
Well, wow. You do have cats.
I do have cats. So, I am a cat person.
Okay, last question.
Not that you're a hybrid man cat.
No.
He's a liger, really.
What have you heard?
He's a liger. So. Okay, last question. Chris is going to get this one.
Hooray.
What chef's signature shoes are orange Crocs?
What? I'm going to get this one?
Yeah. What chef's?
Signature
shoes are orange Crocs. Like those rubber
like the
Crocs.
Rubbery, is it orange rubbery shoes?
So I'm gonna. Is it Emeril?
Incorrect.
No.
Why would I get this?
Because it's a food thing?
I don't know. Gordon Ramsay.
No, Mario Batali.
That's who I was thinking.
I did not know that.
What?
No, I had no idea.
Oh.
I didn't know that.
The Crocs.
All right. Good job, brains. And let's get into our topic of the week. It's inspired by a lot of our personal quirks and fascination. a personal weird thing about me is I can't watch horror movies because I can't stomach gore. But I'm so curious about like what happens and how people die. And I know it sounds kind of morbid. And so one of the series I really like reading about, not watching, reading about, is the Saw movies.
All the elaborate contraptions.
Exactly. Right. I don't know why. It's just it's very creative and it's kind of
I think it combines the appreciation for Rube Goldberg machinery with just the macabre, which I think a lot of nerds would admit to liking both of those things.
And I remember I confessed this to Colin years ago, and I was like, oh, I don't, I'm kind of weird, but I really like reading about like how people die and stuff. And Colin's like, me too, because you used to read like books about traps from like Dungeons and Dragons.
Exactly. I had friends growing up who would play Dungeons and Dragons, and I was always far more interested in these collections of gruesome traps for the Dungeon Master to set, and I would just read them as little stories almost. I found it so fascinating how devious people can be.
Mm-hmm. And I personally think you're all left in the head. I was forced at podcast point to read all about these crazy things.
As you were talking, like a little wave of dread like washed over me. I'm feeling a little nervous now. I did not know that about you guys.
Why are you guys sliding your chairs the other direction?
Hey guys. So for today's episode, we will be talking about eccentric and classic punishment methods throughout history.
There's always been this fascination, like even if you go to like a Ripley's Believe It or Not museum today, especially the one that's in Times Square, where there's like this massive room full of like medieval torture devices. Uh-huh. So people in contemporary times have always kind of been fascinated by older torture devices, things that were used or may have been used in medieval times. And even like in the 18th, 19th centuries, like there'd be exhibitions of medieval torture devices, things like that. And so, you know, you have ones that are meant just simply to mess with people or leave them disfigured, right? But then there's actual like devices that are used for like
executions.
Right. That are sanctioned by some sort of authority or a government.
Yes.
Or,
that's not just like something that some guy has in his basement. Right.
Right. I mean, right. Or not that the Spanish Inquisition wasn't sanctioned, but Well, I think, it's interesting we're talking about the difference between stuff that's just to kind of torture and maim and stuff that's official punishment. Really interesting to me. And, as we're talking about getting ready for the show, capital punishment comes from, as we know, the Latin root for head.
Mm-hmm. Capitalist.
Capital, right, yes. So removing the head is the classic form of capital punishment. You know, I have been really interested in the story of the guillotine for a long time.
Speaking of removing the heads
and official mechanisms, it's just one of those stories that is just so full of irony and all kinds of historical intrigue that... So, I mean, you guys probably know the guillotine associated with France overwhelmingly.
Of course. Right. Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, classic. And, of course, the Reign of Terror with Marie Antoinette and just many, many nobles going to their end at the guillotine. You know, the French didn't invent that device. There were similar devices in other countries and other cultures before then that using the idea of a large blade slicing off the head. But they absolutely perfected it to the point of that we know it today. And so it's named after French physician, Dr. Joseph Guillotin, T-I-N.
Spoke. Oh, so there's a Mr. Guillotin.
There is a Dr. Guillotin. Oh, Dr. Guillotin.
Excuse me.
He didn't go to medical school, so you could call him Mr. Guillotine. Dr. Joseph Ignace Guillotin. And he was, as I say, he was a doctor and a politician. And the irony is he was an anti-death penalty crusader. Yes, he really was part of a group of people active in, you know, in France in the late 1780s who wanted to reform the entire death penalty system. Because at that time, it was, as you say, there was all kinds of...
What was the death penalty before that, then?
Well, it was really varied and kind of all over the map, but essentially it was pretty brutal. You know, there were a lot of devices, you know, that we imagine in sort of medieval torture devices where the agony and the pain was as much of the punishment as putting the person to death. And what was really unjust, you know, to Dr. Guillotin and a lot of other guys was that poor people really had a disproportionate amount of these awful executions, you know. So poor,
of course.
The poor and lower classes could be subjected to hanging and drowning and burning and all sorts of, you know, being beaten to death on the breaking wheel and all these other really nasty devices. Whereas if you were rich or noble enough, you could afford to essentially buy a swift death with an axe.
So he was a pragmatist, basically.
He was.
If he couldn't be anti-death penalty, he would at least create a more humane
death. That's exactly right. So he and a lot of the other politicians, their thought was, all right, then let's start with some sensible steps, small steps. And so their first thought was, let's come up with something that is applied to everybody. Let's make the death penalty really egalitarian. So whether you're rich, poor, it doesn't matter what walk of life you come from, mm-hmm. you get the same swift, easy death that everyone else can get. You know, it's not just for the rich people anymore. It was how they might sell it. But also, you know, the other thing, just that it was clean and efficient. You know, even, you know, reading some of these awful, awful stories about with the Axeman, if he's just off by a few inches or a person struggles, you know, sometimes it would take two blows,
right.
two or three blows to finish somebody off. And it's just gruesome.
Oh, yeah.
So Dr. Guillotin said, this is efficient. We need to come up with a way to do this cleanly, first try. And the other irony, I suppose the final irony, is that he really advocated that execution is a private matter. You know, let's preserve the dignity of even the most heinous criminal deserves dignity in this moment of death. And of course, the popular
image, it's
a public show and public spectacle, which is really how a lot of executions were handled in that time.
Right.
He didn't design the device. He was associated with it, though, because he sort of led the crusade to come up with this device.
Which is noble, I have to say.
It was.
Noble intentions.
It was noble intentions. Mm-hmm. So the man who actually is credited with designing it is Dr. Antoine Louis. And the device was originally known in France as the Louisette or the Louison.
Dr. Louis invented it.
But it did not take long before Guillotin's name, you know, became attached. And it was the guillotine named after him. Yeah, I mean, just to flash forward actually a little bit, after he died, his family had become so kind of mortified, I mean, no pun intended, and ashamed of being associated with the device, they asked the government to change the name. Mm-hmm. And the government's like, nah, it's just so impractical. We got to reprint all these brochures. I mean, they essentially said, no, we're not going to change the name. And they changed their family name. I was not actually able to track that down.
Ironically, they became
Head Choppers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Head Chopper.
Ironically. Well, it's France. It was Head Chopé.
Yeah.
They became the Taser family.
don't guillotine me, bro. But yeah, so I mean, just the order of three or four years, this device that was intended to be a humane, egalitarian, private, swift means of punishment mm-hmm. became associated with the Reign of Terror and public, very gory, publicized executions.
Right. They made it very easy and convenient to just execute.
That's absolutely right. There's one story often told about the guillotine that is not actually true, which is that Louis XVI himself suggested, if you put the blade on a 45-degree angle, it'll really cut a lot more efficiently, mm-hmm. you know, of course, being the joke that he ended up being beheaded that way. But that does not appear to be true. That angle was, in fact, part of the original design team.
And there must be some sort of physics or math
is. It does.
To everything.
It does. Earlier devices, I guess, had a rounded blade, and the 45-degree blade really is far more efficient. They say, some French neurophysicists, even at the time, were really curious about the state of consciousness after beheading. And, again, just sort of this macabre feeling. And by all accounts, it certainly seems to be the case that the head is aware that it has a beheaded head in that brief instant after it's been cut off the body.
Yeah.
But it might be like residue, kind of a nervous activity.
You know, unfortunately,
nobody's around.
No one's around long enough to really be debriefed. Yeah.
We're not good enough at reattaching them to ask.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't outlawed until 1981, capital punishment in France.
1981?
The guillotine was in use in France until as late as 1977.
Wow.
I mean, it is amazing. We have this image of it being, oh, that's 1790s, right. Or, but no, it was up in use well into the 70s.
That's
yeah.
fascinating.
Yeah,
huh.
yeah. Before they,
but it is instant. We believe
it is as instant or as swift a death as you know anything. I think short of a gunshot could be. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes me kind of feel better.
Right. It is much more humane than the breaking wheel. Let's put it that way.
Speaking of the breaking wheel, that's what I was going to talk about. It's otherwise known as the Catherine wheel. Mm-hmm. And
that sounds so nice,
doesn't it? I mean, it's also the name.
They all sound so lovely.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever knew that the band, the Catherine Wheel. I don't think I ever knew that
The 90s alt rock British band. It's also like a firework.
Right.
And
yes.
It's a kind of window. It's also like a really intense torture device. Mm. A person is strapped to a wheel, like maybe a wagon wheel or something like that. And then there are hammers that come out and hit them while it's turning. So like you can beat them to death. And mm-hmm. that's kind of where the coup de grace comes from, where like the mercy blow, like if somebody's you would hit them in the head or like in an organ or something to
because
make it faster.
Unlike the guillotine, this is not instant.
No.
this is the example of the really drawn out, and in this case they wanted it to be really drawn out, yeah. right? Especially in front of a crowd, like you want
right
to
it is
somebody.
It's a public spectacle. Don't let this happen to you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. It's probably why the guillotine wasn't a private matter either. It's still the point of showing everybody this is how we deal with people who violate our social contract or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it was named after St. Catherine of Alexandria. So it existed before she did. So she was going to be killed on it. But the story goes that it fell apart when they were about to attach her to it. And so they ended up beheading her instead.
Oh, okay. Well, that's...
So,
yeah.
Right. So,
well, we got this guillotine. I know. That.
What a way to give your name to something.
Right.
And in fact, the Catherine wheel is on the flag, the coat of arms, for a ton of cities.
Really?
Yes. Really?
Oh, huh. Yeah.
Yeah. Because she's... St. Catherine is their patron saint, and then her symbol is the torture device.
It wasn't used to kill her.
Awkward. Yeah.
I think I assumed that in a lot of cases that was like the wheel of fortune, the wheel of life being represented.
Wheel of death.
Yeah, hey.
Yeah, so, you know, as I was kind of saying in the beginning, a lot of people are, you know, as today, people hundreds of years ago were, of course, fascinated to look at, you know, these medieval instruments of torture, and so, of course, you know, they're the Robert J. Ripley's of the 19th century would, of course, arrange exhibitions and things, and people would, you know, pay a penny to go and just look at these things
right.
and be told
it's like a freak show kind
these
of.
Stories that we're telling now about, oh, this is what they do with it, and then they'd hit you and whatever. And as you might imagine, in the days before, you know, Karen could go onto Wikipedia and fact check, there were a few embellishments or simple outright frauds. Like, and I found out about one of these, for example, people have said that at this point, I couldn't find definitive information on this, but people seem to believe that the Iron Maiden
mm-hmm.
was just fictional.
Right.
That people just assembled these in the 19th century and were like, oh, in medieval times. So the Iron Maiden, just so we're on the same page, is the quintessential medieval torture device. It looks like a large metal statue of a lady, and then the body of it opens up and it's all lined with spikes. So they put you inside like a sarcophagus.
Right, like a sarcophagus.
A vertical sarcophagus with a smiling woman's head on top, and they put you inside and then just close it. And then all the spikes were to go into you, and the whole thing is like, oh, all the spikes are positioned so they actually don't hit your major organs. So you're just in there with the spikes in you forever. Yeah, yeah, until, you know. As far as anybody can figure, the first reference to this stuff, he's a German professor named Johann Philipp Siebenkies in 1793. But the problem is nobody seems to be able to find any other references to it.
He
the
just
way
kind of
that
made
they
it
came
up.
Other things. And they, you know, people might have taken remnants of things that they found from hundreds of years previously and sort of put them back together in ways that they imagined that they might have worked using their imaginations. There was, of course, the famous Iron Maiden of Nuremberg, which was on display in Nuremberg, Germany, and was destroyed in the 1944 Allied bombings, and has since been recreated. Could there have been like photographs of the original, I believe. But again, even this, nobody can go back and date it because it's gone now.
Right,
you know, but
right.
Nobody really knew. Had they, you know, did they just build it in the 1800s and never actually use it? And more recently, interestingly enough, as I was researching Iron Maidens, after the fall of Iraq in 2003, they found an Iron Maiden out in Uday Hussein's
of course
like,
they did.
Backyard. backyard.
Of course they did. Yeah, of course they did.
Right. He was very fond of torture. So he may in fact have actually used that on people. We don't really know. Oh. But they had an old, you know, rusted Iron Maiden out in his backyard.
Whoa.
Yeah.
See, that's the original saw contraption. We don't know if it's true or not. I mean, it's just some dude is like, hey, check this out.
But yeah,
I designed this.
Take it all with a grain of salt when you hear about the medieval torture devices, because you don't actually necessarily know if they were used contemporaneously or not, because in a lot of cases there's no record of that having happened. And again, in the days before fact-checking, there was a lot of money to be made in terms of like charging people a penny each to go and look at these crazy things that, for all they knew, you just made it yesterday, you know, and just rusted it up.
Well, I mean, the idea that sensationalism sells tickets is certainly not new. Yes.
Exactly. It's
that makes so much sense. Speaking of these medieval devices, especially the Iron Maiden, imagine the cleanup afterwards. Unlike the guillotine, that totally makes sense because it is very efficient. Yeah, it is very easy to clean. But a lot of these devices, whether if they're real or not, it's like, man. Like,
well, you know, I'll be honest.
Some poor dude has to peel a dude.
One reason I only use disposable Iron Maidens. I am so busy, I cannot be bothered with the cleanup.
They're made out of like compostable.
They're biodegradable.
Corn.
They're compostable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Corn.
I just put them in my yard waste bin.
Oh my gosh.
Just picturing a commercial of like a woman running, you know, in a white dress through a field of garden flowers, you know, and like 30 seconds later, it's like disposable Iron Maiden.
If you care.
Nope.
It does sound like a feminine product, doesn't it? Like a feminine care product.
Speaking of torture methods that you can't really prove or disprove just because there's not a lot of information. I was watching Game of Thrones. Season 2.
I already don't like where this is going.
Yeah,
is this a spoiler alert?
This is not a spoiler. Okay. It's just kind of offhand. They had a torture scene, and as I was watching, I didn't really pay attention. I didn't really figure out like how everything works. This is in the background. So basically, they would sit a guy down in a chair, and they would put like a live rat in a bucket, like a pail, mm-hmm. you know, pail sized bucket, and they would take the rim, like the lip of the pail, and kind of put it on the guy's stomach with the rat in there, and they would heat it up with fire. They would heat the bucket up with fire. And so, you know, I'm watching this. I was like, oh yeah, whatever. It didn't really connect for me what is like, happening.
What making happen? Roasted rats do.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, this guy's screaming. And I finally, I went online and I'm like, okay, is this a historical torture method? And it's called rat torture or rat excitement. Well, I mean, basically.
They got excited.
There's some good marketing on that one.
Yeah, exactly. Exciting rats.
This sounds like something that this sounds more real because it's like you don't have to construct an elaborate device. True. All you need is a rat in a bucket, you know,
and
which were in plentiful supply in those days.
They were knee deep in rats and buckets.
When I read about what actually is going on, I kind of like threw open my mouth because I just didn't think about it. It's the rats get really excited and they're really uncomfortable. Yeah, and so the only thing they can do, they can't get out bucket.
Oh,
they're
no.
like, oh, look, it's the fleshy kind of cooler part.
Right.
And they start burrowing and scraping into the person's stomach, which is kind of like...
It's like that tofu that we talked about in the previous episode. Yes.
But you're the tofu.
Yeah. What is it? Dojo Nabe?
I believe so, yes.
It was where the eels...
Joke's on you.
Yeah.
You're the tofu.
Man, and
shudder.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there are references to it in literature, but it's probably just not true.
Right.
People probably didn't make there are references in Orwell's 1984 and even in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
Yes.
But there's actually historical examples or you know, can't really find anything. Mm-hmm. But I do want to talk about in terms of execution, classic pirate executions.
Oh, right.
Those are fun. And a lot of
not for the person being executed. For everybody else on the boat, they were super fun. Yeah.
And I have to say, I did a lot of research, and I was grossed out by the different... There are a lot of different cases of different pirates and captains doing very effed up things. And most of them are like beating people to death or whatever.
Lashing them
variations.
To the mast.
Yeah. Definitely some classic pirate torture and execution that I want to talk about. Keel haul.
Oh, yeah.
Which I didn't know what it meant. I always thought it was like, you know, kind of like a piratey term.
I, I probably used that word for years, like doing pirate play. I'll kill all you without knowing what it meant.
Yeah, right. It's in Mario games, like Keel Hall Bay. That's a place in Mario.
Oh, okay.
Keel Hall refers to a person who is tied to a rope and a pulley system, and the victim is dragged back and forth underneath the ship.
That's where the keel is. Mm. They're hauled across the keel.
Hauled across the keel. And, I mean, that already sounds unpleasant because you have to be underwater.
In the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, these big ships, they have barnacles growing on the side.
Oh, yeah.
And so the bodies would be scraped against these sharp barnacle structures. Man. Yeah. And
that's a real one, right?
Yeah, I mean,
this is a real one.
This
did happen, right? I mean, at best as we can tell.
And, of course, we have walking the plank, which is very famous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, not as common as most people think it is.
Boring. They walk off a plank, they disappear into the ocean. And they're gone. Like, who cares? That's not fun. That's not passing the hours.
It's very efficient. Yeah, it's but too efficient.
Too efficient. Why not just throw them?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like the way like doing the rat in the bucket is not very efficient. It seems like it would take a long time for.
Yeah, but again, it's not like
there were more efficient ways. Yeah, they had fire.
Yeah,
like, right in there.
Yeah, but it's like they didn't have Netflix in those days. So I mean, it's like just filling the hours.
Well, I can see walking the plank.
Fire
being a staple of like movies and TV because like walking the plank just has so much drama.
Tension.
You're inching out to the edge. Like
exactly
pauses. But yeah, it doesn't seem practical at all.
And it's not
throw them off the edge. Yeah.
And in literature and movies and whatnot, it's not as gruesome as the other things. So walking the plank seems like it's a very high tension, but
it's
low
great,
gore.
You know what? It's good for kids. It's good for pirate movies for kids. Oh, I'll make you walk the plank, and they walk off a plank, and they go into the ocean.
Right, and you just don't need to see what happens after that.
Right. Yeah. They took the keel hauling scene out of Peter Pan.
Do you guys know what the hempen jig is? Hempen. H-E-M-P-E-N jig.
I've heard this before. Gosh.
It sounds fun.
Do they tie him up? Do they tie him up in a rope?
No, I've totally heard what the
hempen
jig is.
Okay.
Oh, hempen jig is basically pirate term for hanging.
Okay.
Rope made out of hemp.
You're dancing at the end of the rope.
So I got the dancing part. That's the part I understood.
But not the morbid part.
I was like, hemp, though. That also sounds possibly fun.
There are a lot of gruesome stuff with pirates. A lot of historians would agree that the cruelest form of torment or execution is called governor of the island. Do we know what that is?
That you abandon somebody?
Yep, exactly. Right. It is marooning someone, the pirate in question or the victim.
Right.
Usually, you know, they're marooned on rock islands. You know, we see in movies, they're like vast islands, kind of
palm trees and lagoons.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, these are
just
like
rock. Yeah.
Rock out on the ocean.
A chunk of coral or something.
Mm-hmm. And so the victim, basically, this is standard, he would be left with the clothes he's wearing, right? Mm-hmm. A bottle of water or rum or alcohol, a pistol, and powder and a shot.
Okay.
There are a lot of ways that a person could perish in this situation. Obviously, at high tide, the water might flood the island or rock.
Right, may go away.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And he would drown. There are also sharks abound. Why this may be the cruelest is because of the psychological torment of having that gun there and basically making the person commit suicide and shoot himself, which, you know, might be a more merciful death than being mauled by sharks or drowning or whatnot.
But you're right. The psychological torment is almost as bad as any physical torment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, under the heat and the sun, like, people go crazy.
So kids, don't run away and hang out with pirates.
Don't do it. It's not worth it.
So I have a little bit of pirate trivia, not really related to torture or execution, but very interesting. So do you guys know the rhyme or the song, Sing a Song of Sixpence?
Yes.
Yeah. Pocket full of rye.
4 and 20 blackbirds baking a pie.
So do you guys know where that came from?
Something with pirates, I guess.
So there is a...
When the pie was open, the birds began to sing. Wasn't that a something, 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 something
place
king?
Place to fight a king. Yeah.
There's a big urban legend or myth or origin story that very widely believed that Sing a Song of Sixpence was used by Blackbeard for recruitment.
Mm. Oh.
So they would sing the song, and obviously their different verses have different meanings, hidden meanings, but it's used to recruit pirates for Blackbeard.
Okay.
And that's very widely kind of believed.
Okay.
And it is actually false.
No!
It has been in Discovery Channel, has been in board games and literature, you know, quoting that this is all Blackbeard's recruitment song. Actually fake. And the origin of this rumor is from Snopes.com. Snopes.com are our big kind of urban legend debunking myth.
So what, they planted this rumor?
They planted it. It was a joke.
Just to sort of see if they could spread.
They have a section called Lost Legends, and basically it's just internet trolling. They have all these really elaborate and almost believable. I mean, it's so crazy.
I love that.
Bad for their credibility. It's like, because they're like, oh no, we'll debunk it. We'll tell you if it's true or not. And then they're also placing fake things.
It was done as a joke.
I think it's good because it shows how easily a single bad source of information can be replicated.
They're like, and we are a bad source of information, so there you go.
Trust us this time.
So not actually a pirate song, everybody.
I had never heard that before, so you lied to me and then erased the lie. but no, I mean, you know, there was an inflection point where, like, suddenly just everybody just started getting all their information off of the nascent, you know, internet, right. You know, and it was just like TV shows and everything, just like at some point, people just all started trusting the internet, and just the first website they found, man, they would just write that down and use it as gospel.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Are you looking for a podcast that your whole family can enjoy that asks the deep philosophical questions like, do trees fart?
If you are, then you'll love Tumble, a science podcast for kids. I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Marshall. Join us as we explore stories of science discovery, from butts to animals, dinosaurs, astronomy, and everything in between.
You'll love these stories, and you'll learn something new.
Find and follow Tumble Science Podcast for Kids wherever you get your podcasts, or at sciencepodcastforkids.com.
So when we were talking about torture, one thing kind of jumped to my head as something that I wanted to investigate and look into, and not necessarily this would be considered torture, but in terms of, like, you know, whatever it is, sort of applying pressure on somebody to try to get them to do something that you want them to. Mm-hmm. And
like the Vulcan pinch?
Yeah. Well, no, metaphorical pressure.
Got it.
I'm the nerd making Star Wars references, and you can just slip in Vulcan pinch and no one blames.
So I'm going to I'll throw this out
Colin,
there as a...
persecuted. nerd persecution.
I got the Star Wars reference. Sorry. So I'll throw this out there as a sort of a quiz, just to see if anybody can get this answer. So in 1989, U.S. forces invaded Panama under the name Operation Just Cause, in an effort to throw out dictator Manuel Noriega.
Right.
When they went into Panama, Noriega ended up holing up in the Vatican Embassy in Panama. Not hiding there, but he was in there basically protected because it was the Vatican Embassy.
There's a Vatican Embassy?
In Panama.
Yeah. Only in Panama? Are there other ones?
Yeah, of course there are.
Sure.
Oh.
The Vatican is a country. It has embassies in other countries.
Oh.
Hold up
and
in the Vatican Embassy.
And I thought John Lewis.
And so the United States, very kind of famously at that point, put on a program to try to force him out of there by playing at high volume loud heavy metal music.
Oh, that's right.
No!
Yeah.
It was like setting up massive speakers and just flooding the Vatican Embassy with loud music. Yeah, because they can't just walk in there. But they tried to break him down by, like, playing this music, including several popular 1980s songs, but including which Van Halen song? Would anybody like to venture a guess as to... which Ooh. Van Halen song they might play at him?
Oh, Panama. Oh.
Indeed.
Yes.
They played the song Panama. So in fact...
The military doesn't have a sense of humor.
So Southcom Network Radio, which was the radio station that was, like, listened to by the troops while they were... Southcom as being, like, U.S. Southern Command. So that was the radio station that they would play music on for the troops, and that was what they were playing to them. And so that radio station actually took requests for songs from the troops as to what songs they wanted to blare into the Vatican.
Wow.
And of course, many of them...
To
get Noriega out. And so many of them had a not-so-subtle message. So some of the songs that were played, there's a list. So some of the songs were Judas Priest, You've Got Another Thing Coming, Billy Joel's Big Shot, Tom Petty's Feel a Whole Lot Better When You're Gone, and Rolling Stone's Rockin' a Hard Place. Some of the songs, just some of them that were
That's
blared
great.
In there.
This one's going out to Manny N. Hiding in the embassy.
Exactly. And so what's interesting is I thought about, okay, this idea of, like, you know, blaring loud music into something to get people to come out.
We did it work. It worked.
I mean, you know, they got them out of there. Yeah. I'm sure it wasn't pleasant for anyone. Yeah. But the thing is, I actually couldn't find very many examples of this being used in any significant capacity. I would only find actually a couple of more examples of this in the news.
I would expect, because it's more of a modern age time. You know,
it is modern. Exactly.
Back then, it's like the violin can play as loud as it can. It's not like you can amplify it.
Exactly. It was something that you would have to have modern, like, rock concert technology for, right?
Exactly.
You
know? Amplification. Yeah.
Exactly. And so there just probably aren't very many situations in which it's going to be used. Later, a couple of years later, in 1983, according to Entertainment Weekly, this is another quiz question, by the way, Tibetan chants, bugle calls, Christmas carols, and Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking were blasted at very high volume into a religious organization's compound in what city?
Oh, Waco?
Yes. So, in fact, the FBI blared music into the Branch Davidian compound, David Koresh and his followers in Waco.
Is it bad? I would like that music. I don't think it would be torture to me. I think
high volume.
Once, maybe, yeah. But after 30 times through, you might be a little sick of
you
these
haven't
boots
seen
are made
my
for...
Spotify yeah. playlist.
Indeed. And in fact, just this past May, a new report said, another question for you guys, that the theme songs of what two popular children's television programs were used in interrogations
of
Guantanamo Bay prisoners.
Teletubbies?
No.
One of them was Barney.
One of them was, in fact, Barney.
Yeah. Huh.
In fact, this is a direct quote. In training, they forced me to listen to the Barney I Love You song for 45 minutes, said a U.S. soldier to Newsweek in 2003. I never want to go through that
Oh, just to get them prepped and primed.
So that they would understand what the psychological toll is of having to listen to this at loud volume.
Is this a song that never ends? That
it is.
Too?
It is not. That would be great. But no, it's in fact the Sesame Street theme song.
Oh,
yeah. The Guardian also reported, this was again this report from this past May, that
these are great trivia.
Other tracks used played at Guantanamo prisoners included Metallica's Enter Sandman and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
Oh dear.
Okay.
They switched to Britney Spears after they found out that they could just play it one time on normal volume and they would just tell them everything that they wanted.
Cost cutting measures.
And they call it futility music to convince people of the futility of not cooperating, because really they just want to get information out of people, like, who are you? Who do you work for? How did you, you know, just start telling us everything. And by just playing this music over and over and over again.
And it's
just
clean, sort of, again.
It just breaks you down.
No,
right?
No violence, really, just psychological kind of messing with people. And one of the classic torture methods that I want to talk about is, of course, me being Chinese, would be fitting to talk about the Chinese water torture.
That's just straight up racist, Karen.
Yeah, so racist.
You don't have to do that. Why do you hate yourself?
So for those who don't know, Chinese water torture is basically a victim is restrained, and there's like a bucket or some sort of apparatus that drips water. Droplets of water would hit on your forehead, kind of between your eyes. Mm-hmm. You listen to that, you're like, that's whatever. It doesn't sound that bad. Apparently, it drives people crazy.
It's just the regular, steady, just drip, right?
So, to go back, the Chinese water torture actually is not Chinese. It is invented by an Italian dude, Hippolytus de Marcellus. And so he's credited with inventing a form of water torture. And he kind of got the idea because he saw droplets of water falling one by one on a stone and gradually made a little divot,
right.
like a hollow. So he's like, what will happen if I do this to the human body? There is a very famous episode of Mythbusters where they actually try to debunk or support whether or not this is an actual valid kind of form of torture. It is very unpleasant.
I remember that, and it didn't take long. I remember watching on that show. Again, it's the kind of thing where you imagine as a kid, I remember hearing about it. I'm like, it's just water on your head. What is that?
Right.
But very quickly, I can see if you're just restrained there.
So that's the thing. I mean, people have found, and scientists and researchers have found, that dripping water on the forehead wasn't really particularly stressful or, you know, effective as a torture method. It's the combination of the restraining, immobilizing the victim, and the water drop is actually not regular. It is random. So the victim wouldn't know when the next drop is coming.
Mm. Oh, man. Mm.
But it can see the collection of water, like, up ahead. Mm. Mostly psychological and just discomfort and being restrained. And so that is Chinese water torture.
You know, one of the more really common ones in terms of pop culture, and, you know, I remember growing up, is, like, the stocks and the pillories, mm-hmm. right? You know, like, we see it in cartoons about colonial times and medieval times.
I don't
times,
know what those are.
So I know you know them if I describe them. So the stocks and the pillories are, you have that image of the person who's done something wrong, and they're in a board that's either holding their head and their hands captive.
Oh!
And, you know, often the image will be of the person in the town square with his head and hands through the board, captive, upright. And people are throwing tomatoes at him, or, you know.
Cabbage.
Those are the pillories. So the stocks are pretty much the same thing, but the stocks are for your feet. So they tend to be lower on the ground.
Oh, okay.
And so it would be mm-hmm. the two planks that would hold. They would go around your ankles. And
like socks.
There you go. That's how you can remember it. Stocks like socks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was pretty popular in medieval times, and it came.
Does it count as torture or just kind of like it humiliation?
Well, so it was really, the goal was more public humiliation and punishment, you know, and it would be for anything from theft to various petty crimes up to more serious crime, perjury, things even like that. And the idea is that you're in the public square being humiliated for what you did. And generally it would be, you know, a few hours, maybe up to a few days, depending on what you did. Reading about it was so much more than just being in the thing and having a tomato thrown at you. So it was a very public spectacle to be on pilloried. Mm. So you would be taken, you'd be put into the pillory. A big notice will go out to the town. Hey everyone, there's someone in the pillory in the town square. Come on down.
Look.
Yeah. Come jeer.
Come
and
on down.
You could essentially had license to do whatever you want. You people would throw rotten eggs and moldy fruit and fish guts and feces, and you could spit on people. I mean, it was really kind of just free license to really let the person have it.
And so it was where they where composting came from.
Because, it was at the base
because they
of the
found
post.
Out that at the base of the post, rich soil would develop. Yeah.
All these earthworms.
So earthy around here. So I don't know what this says about me, but reading about the things that would happen to you, somehow the food and all these things being thrown at me sounds terrible, but apparently the village children would come and just tickle your feet mercilessly.
Oh!
So you just imagine being locked in this thing and people are hurling insults at you, but you've got the village children tickling your feet while you're locked in there. I mean, I don't mean to make light of it, but...
And you're just laughing your ass off while absolutely your poop terrible. Is getting like flung your into your face.
Right.
Wet willies.
And as I say, you know, this
Hertz
came...
Donuts.
This
so was, many Hertz donuts.
So many Hertz donuts. The one thing, again, an image from popular culture is it's related to a barrel pillorying, which is if you were like the town drunk or doing something bad for drunk, they would put a barrel over you. And it came in two forms. Like either they would cut the hole out and stick you in the barrel. But another form is there would be the bottom would be cut out and you would essentially wear the barrel like a shirt. Mm. And that image of sort of the town
I see that
drunk,
all the time.
I see that all the time in, you know, as cartoons. I say, colonial or pilgrim or Puritan
Waldo?
Era. Right. And I think as a kid, my thinking was always like, oh, that town drunk, he lost his clothes. All he has is a barrel.
Right. Yeah.
But no, that was the punishment for being the drunk and disorderly was they would take your clothes and you would have to wear that barrel around for whatever the duration of your sentence. Was.
Oh man!
Yeah,
and you know, talk about going to the bathroom. That's a little grody.
So yes,
I looked up being tarred and feathered. And feathering. Being tarred and feathered sounds really brutal. Like tar is, you know,
it's the heat. Yeah.
It's
like hot.
It's really hot.
And it's cooking your skin. Steady.
You make asphalt out of it, or you put it on roofs to patch it. And yes, that kind of tar would burn you, and it probably would. Kill you to have that poured over you. They probably were talking about pine tar most of the time, which has a lower boiling point, and they use it on ropes, so it has to be flexible. And sailors actually would—they'd put their hands in it. There's a reference to it in Moby Dick.
Well, that's what baseball players use pine tar, tar resin to hold the bat better, or pitchers will put it on the ball, or
It probably hurts, but usually people didn't die. At least when they did, a bunch during the American Revolution, and those people didn't usually die. There were
just the adhesive,
the stick. Part, nothing.
They just had to take a long shower afterwards.
Yeah. It was a very political thing to do because it's so humiliating and it's like a vigilante justice kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they did it to tax collectors or like debt collectors or strip their shirt off and then paint them with the tar and then feather them. People have died from it.
Yeah, I always had the idea that it was like boiling hot road tar or something. Mm.
They did it to Joseph Smith Jr., the founder of the Latter-day Saints.
Huh.
They did it to him. And do you know what... collaboration horizontal is? Have you heard of that?
No. Urban Dictionary.
It sounds a little dirty.
I know.
Well, it kind of is. I'm glad I said it in the right tone. So it's kind of the idea of you're sleeping with the enemy. So ladies who who were the girlfriends of German soldiers, it would happen to them. It happened, you know, the collaboration. Horizontal
collaboration.
That's so funny.
Very PC.
What a military. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Oh, and I feel like this may come up in trivia, but Edgar Allan Poe wrote a short story about tarring and feathering.
Huh.
And it's called, it has a very wacky name. It didn't sound very Edgar Allan Poe to me, so that's why I feel like it would be a trick trivia question. And it's called The System of Dr. Tar and Professor Feathers. And it features the staff of an insane asylum.
Sounds like a children's book.
Doesn't it?
I read Professor Feathers' dissertation, and I have to tell you, I'm not convinced.
He deserved everything he got.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, it was kind of intense. It was kind of heavy, but very interesting.
I think safe to say we could have gone much more gruesome if we had wanted to.
Let's move on to a more lighter affair, because for our last trivia segment, we have Music Round.
Yay!
Music Round
is back. Yay! Return to music.
We're just going to play an incredibly loud...
Usually, Music Round, I will be playing 5 clips of music, short clips, and you would have to identify the artist performing the song. Mm-hmm. And there is a theme, but I'm going to tell you the theme to this round because there is a second part to the quiz. I will be playing songs made famous from movies.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that's the theme. And not only do you have to tell me, identify the artist performing the song, you have to also identify what movie was the song featured
in. So each one is a two-parter.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Are you guys ready? Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Pass.
I don't know.
No one. I don't know.
What was
it's
that?
It's Hold Me, Throw Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me, but I don't know the artist. I'm sorry.
It? No. Smashing Pumpkins or something?
On kind of the right track. Hold Me, Kiss Me, Thrill Me, Kill Me. By U2.
It sounded like U2. Yeah. Okay.
I
doubted myself. It did sound like U2.
Ignorance
but I don't know
on
what,
display.
But
sorry.
I don't know what movie it's from. I'm gonna.
This was a big hit.
I'm gonna guess like one.
It
of
was
the
a
Batman.
Big hit.
I'm gonna guess one of the Batman movies.
Correct.
Really?
Oh, all right.
It was from Batman Forever.
Okay. Oh,
and you probably remember the famous song, which is Seal's Kiss from a Rose.
Sure. Okay.
Which
was
also in that same album. And Smashing Pumpkin. The end is the beginning is the end, or the beginning is the end is the beginning. Whatever.
I simply made the wise choice of not seeing Batman Forever.
Yeah. some part of my brain dug it out.
The interesting thing about this was a very popular album, and it sold a lot. It did really, really well. And you actually didn't have to watch the movie because only 5 of the songs of the whole soundtrack album are actually in the movie.
When they do that.
All the rest are allegedly
inspired
quote,
by
exactly
inspired by
Batman Forever. And you know, a lot of these tracks were recorded before. They're just in upcoming albums, before they, you know,
I think
the
that
movie.
Happens a lot.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Or it's a track that got cut from the studio album and they're like, "Oh, we already got this finished
We need
track.
A song." Right. Yeah. Right. So good job, even though...
Not really.
Bombed it.
Okay, here we go. Number 2. Very famous scene.
That is the Pixies, Where Is My Mind, from the final scene in Fight Club.
Correct!
Yes, that's the trifecta for me. It's one of my favorite bands, one of my favorite songs, and one of my favorite movies/books.
Mm. Yep. It's that scene between Helena Bonham Carter.
Or really, just Edward Norton, Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah. Holding hands, watching all the buildings kind of get bombed out and fall. Very beautiful.
Yeah.
Very good job. Next one.
I'm a
Dana.
Why did I race you to it? But I think it's Bon Jovi.
Correct.
Is it Young Guns or Tombstone?
It's one of those is Cowboy it Silverado or Young Guns? It's one of those, right?
Okay, it is not Young Guns. It is Young Guns 2. specifically right. For the second Young Guns movie, 1990 Young Guns 2. Emilio Estevez, one of the stars of Young Guns 2, originally asked that Bon Jovi's Wanted Dead or Alive to become the theme music for Young Guns 2. John Bon Jovi he didn't allow it.
Huh.
He said no. So instead, he actually, he's not a bad guy. He still wrote a new song, which is Blaze of Glory, this song, to be used in Young Guns 2, and actually ended up with the Oscar nomination.
That's pretty... I did not know that. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
That was his way of no, sorry, but here's something else.
Exactly. And to be honest, I think Wanted Dead or Alive is a much better song.
But maybe he knew that, too.
Yeah. I think so. All right, here we go. From behind the walls of doubt, a voice was crying out. Save you, save me. Chris.
Well, the song is Say You, Save Me by Lionel Richie, right?
Correct.
Movie. Oh, I don't know. Colin looks like he knows that.
I believe it was from White Nights.
Correct.
Yes.
White Nights, 1985.
Gregory Hines, Mikhail Baryshnikov.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Very famous, the original Step Up. No. A very, very famous dance movie starring Mikhail.
But was it in 3D?
No, it was not in 3D. But it would have been awesome if it was in 3D, though, because those two guys are fantastic dancers.
Yeah, yeah.
And also Helen Mirren was also in that movie as well.
Oh, I didn't remember
very
that at all.
Young Helen Mirren. Yep. And, the last song. You sing to one smile that cheers you, one face that lights when it nears you, one girl you're everything.
Oh, God. I feel like it's on the tip of my tongue. It feels familiar. I don't know.
Who sings it?
Can we get hints?
It is an old song, but it is not necessarily for a old-timey movie.
Is it Jimmy Durante?
Correct.
Okay, I know it's Jimmy
Make
Durante.
Someone happy.
Oh, God, yeah. What is it? It's from... I feel like it's from some sort of mid-80s, late 80s.
Like Sleepless in Seattle or something. Like that. Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sleepless in Seattle.
I swear, I was going to say some sort of Billy Crystal or Tom Hanks movie. Yeah. I really was.
Starring Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks. And it's not an old-timey movie, but there's a lot of old-timey nostalgia, especially classic movies, songs.
Well, they have the running. Am I thinking of the right movie where they're all sort of the female characters are watching An Affair to Remember throughout the movie?
And they're meeting up on top of Empire State Building. Good job, everyone.
Good job, Brain.
And so that is our show. Thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about torture and execution.
Hope it wasn't too torturous.
Yeah. Hopefully, y'all.
Funny.
Good. And also, importantly, you know the difference between alliteration and assonance and consonants.
And, most importantly, we now know.
And you can find us on Dune Marketplace, on iTunes, on Stitcher, and also on our website, goodjobbrain.com. We also have a Twitter page, which is just @goodjobbrain, and also a Facebook page, and we put some interesting tidbits and video and facts and questions and stuff. So you should join us there, and we'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye now. Bye-bye. Bye-bye now.
We When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.